Palestinian resistance groups say Israel cannot guarantee its security by killing Palestinians and pledge to avenge the blood of their martyrs. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan accuses the US of a regime change attempt and a blatant interference in his country's domestic affairs. Also ahead, Ukraine says Russian forces are rapidly retreating from northern areas as humanitarian corridors open for evacuations in Mariupol and other besieged cities. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. And our top story this hour, three more Palestinians are killed in an Israeli shooting, this time in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. It brings to 10 the number of Palestinians killed this week so far. Reports say the Israeli regime's forces rained down bullets on a car the three Palestinians were traveling in. They are also said to have seized the bodies of the victims. The Israeli military claims the trio was planning to launch an attack. The resistance group Islamic Jihad says the victims were its members and that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished. Hamas has also pledged to avenge the killing. It says Israel's policy of terror and assassination would only galvanize resistance and warns that the regime cannot guarantee its security by killing Palestinians. Israeli regime forces have recently intensified their violent raids on Palestinian cities and villages. A fresh escalation erupted after Palestinians, angry over the regime's crimes and occupation, killed 11 Israelis in separate attacks. Iran welcomes a temporary UN proposed truce in Yemen that would allow the entry of much-needed fuel and food to the war-torn country, as well as a partial opening of Sana'a International Airport. In a statement, Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khazibzadeh expressed hope that the ceasefire will help alleviate a dire humanitarian situation there. He said the move could be a prelude to the complete lifting of siege and the establishment of a permanent ceasefire to find a political solution to the crisis. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen announced that warring parties had agreed to a two-month truce starting Saturday, ahead of the holy month of Ramadan. Hans Grundberg said they have also accepted to halt air, ground and maritime operations inside Yemen and across its borders. Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement have welcomed the truce that would also ease sea and air restrictions imposed on Yemen. Political analyst Saeed Shahabi tells us why Saudi Arabia has agreed to the ceasefire in Yemen at this point.
Of course, this is a positive step. And it indicates several facts. Number one, that the Saudis may have reached the end of the road in their aggression against Yemen, the Saudis and the Emiratis, of course, who have waged the war for the past 7 years. Number two, that finally and hopefully that the world has now awakened to the fact that they have forgotten this war for so long and left the Yemenis to their own fate. And despite the fact that they have endured enormous pressures and suffering. Number three, it is coming after the world has discovered that Yemen is undergoing the most and the most severe humanitarian crisis in recent times. So all in all, the Saudis had no way but to concede defeat. They have been defeated. They have not been able to take over Yemen. The people of Yemen have managed to resist them for 7 years, and that the opinion of the world, the world public opinion, is turning against them. So it is a positive step that this ceasefire is taking place, although it is limited for 2 months. But the hope is that the Saudis may have realized by now that their efforts have been futile and that their strategy has drastically failed.
Turning elsewhere, Pakistan's embattled prime minister has accused the US of backing regime change in his country. Imran Khan says the move to remove him from power is a blatant interference in domestic politics by the US. He is facing a no-confidence vote on Sunday, with an opposition claiming to have the necessary votes to oust him. The White House has denied that the US is seeking to remove Khan from power. In a sign of division between the Pakistani government and the military army chief, General Qamar Javed Bajwa said Islamabad seeks to expand its relationship with Washington. This a day after Islamabad protested to the U.S. Embassy over alleged interference in its internal affairs. Moving on, it's day 38 of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Seven humanitarian corridors will reportedly open to evacuate people from several besieged regions. The corridors include one in Mariupol, where a Red Cross team will be involved in evacuating civilians. That's as Ukraine says Russian forces are making a, quote, rapid retreat from areas around the capital Kiev and the northern city of Chernihiv. Russia had earlier announced it would back operations in two cities in an effort to boost mutual trust in negotiations. But an advisor to the Ukrainian president now says Russia is possibly mobilizing to conduct strikes in the east and the south. Earlier, Moscow also accused Kiev of carrying out an airstrike on a fuel depot in the Russian city of Belgorod. It warned that the attack could hamper peace talks. A top Ukrainian security official has, however, denied any involvement. The U.S. announces an additional $300 million worth of military assistance for Ukraine to boost its defense capabilities against Russia. The latest Pentagon package includes laser-guided rocket systems, drones, and armored vehicles, among other equipment. This adds to the $1.6 billion military assistance Washington has committed since Russia started its operation in Ukraine over a month ago. A Pentagon spokesman says the latest move underscores America's unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, discussed ways to help the Ukrainian military. According to U.S. media reports, Washington has also decided to facilitate the transfer of Soviet-era-made tanks from its allies to Ukraine. Russia's military operation in Ukraine and the West's response by imposing a flurry of sanctions against Moscow have renewed the debate whether such punitive measures result in the desired outcome. Voices from Washington's very political establishment are warning about the dire consequences of waging an economic war against Russia. They are also questioning the legality of the U.S. involvement in this conflict.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massie, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with the country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions.
Russian gas accounted for 40% of European Union's total gas imports and 45% of its gas consumption in 2021. Even before the Russian operation in Ukraine, the bloc had been experiencing a rise in gas prices. Imposing sanctions while having no real substitute at this point doesn't seem like the most sensible choice for Europe. It appears that anti-Russia sanctions are set to backfire on the West, especially when it comes to ordinary people.
As the US takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. US House Representative Thomas Massie agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massie says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know. And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Elsewhere in Sri Lanka, a 36-hour curfew has been announced as protests against food and fuel shortages turn violent. The order came a day after President Gotabaya Rajapaksa invoked a state of emergency following a violent attempt to storm his house, saying it was for the protection of public order. The military has since been deployed and has the power to arrest suspects without warrants. 53 people were arrested on Friday alone. Hundreds of protesters clashed with the military outside Rajapaksa's residence on Thursday. The demonstrators called for his removal over economic mismanagement and torched several police and army vehicles. The island nation of 22 million is facing severe shortages of essentials, sharp price rises, and crippling power cuts. Iranian families are celebrating the ancient tradition of Sizdah Bedar, or Nature's Day, by spending some quality time outdoors with their family. Yusuf Jalali has this report.
Parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizda Bedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizda Bedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizda Bedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizda Bedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizda Bedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizda Bedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like arsh and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizda Bedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000 years in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other communities. Everyone must have missed outdoor gatherings after more than 2 years of COVID restrictions. Now that worries over the pandemic have eased to some extent, Sizda Bedar once again reunited Iranians with Mother Nature, with all the good vibes and hope for a world free of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. to fund the global fight against COVID-19 is a choice to extend the pandemic, said one public health expert. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden wants to give 163 times more to U.S. military than to global pandemic response. Here's the story. One day after President Joe Biden asked Congress to approve a record-shattering $813 billion U.S. military budget, public health advocates are lamenting that his fiscal year 2023 spending blueprint requests roughly 163 times less funding to help mitigate the COVID-19 pandemic on a global scale. The defense budget request is $813 billion. By comparison, the White House has asked for just $5 billion to fight global COVID, or $22.5 billion to fight COVID in total. Peter May Barduk, director of Public Citizens Access to Medicines Program, said in a statement recently, adding, that's roughly 3% of defense spending to help end a pandemic that has taken more American lives than any war, and nearly 20 million lives worldwide so far, referring to estimates of excess mortality. Lindsay Kashigarian, director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, said in a statement recently that $813 billion, the president's request for the Pentagon, exceeds even the $782 billion budget that Congress just passed by $31 billion. The increase alone is twice the amount that Congress refused for ongoing COVID aid for antivirals, vaccines, and tests after nearly 1 million Americans have died of the virus. Earlier this month, as Common Dreams reported, Democratic congressional leaders removed $15.6 billion in coronavirus relief from a recently passed $1.5 billion omnibus spending bill after Republican lawmakers, questioning the need for any new funding to fight the pandemic, insisted on repurposing money already allocated to state programs. Democratic lawmakers are reportedly trying to find a way to pass a coronavirus aid package separately. In the meantime, however, the defunding of the U.S. pandemic response, which the GOP spearheaded as infectious caused by an Omicron subvariant surged in Europe and Asia, sparking fears of an imminent wave at home, has led to what one physician called the rationing of COVID care by ability to pay. Last week, a federal health agency tasked with covering COVID-19 testing and treatment for uninsured people in the U.S. stopped accepting claims, and those patients will now be charged $125 for a single PCR test. On the global front, May Barduk warned that without emergency funding, vaccines will expire on shelves in countries where they are needed most. The extraordinary efforts of scientists, health workers, and activists worldwide to develop, manufacture, and distribute life-saving medicine against COVID will falter for want of the least we could ask of governments. As lawmakers discuss Biden's funding request for the domestic and international pandemic response, May Barduk pointed out that health experts called for $17 billion from Congress to resource the global fight, emphasizing that $5 billion is the bare minimum needed to prevent global vaccination testing and emergency relief from screeching to a halt. In a recent report documenting the harmful economic impacts of global vaccine inequity on informal workers and other vulnerable populations in low-income countries, the United Nations estimated that it would cost just $18 billion to vaccinate 70% of the world's population by mid-2022. Public Citizen, for its part, has developed a blueprint showing how the U.S., with a $25 billion investment, could establish regional manufacturing hubs to produce 8 billion life-saving doses in less than a year. Ending the pandemic is a choice, said May Bardugh, adding Congress must step up and pass funds to support the White House's already pared back request. Failing to fund the global fight against COVID-19 is a choice to extend the pandemic, to accept preventable suffering and insecurity for all, and to live with the knowledge that deep in the time of the world's greatest need, the United States gave up. Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen, wrote recently on social media that as elected officials race toward a $1 trillion Pentagon budget, this shameful spending makes the U.S. less secure. Washington, he warned, will be more likely to engage in warfare and no more able to address pandemics or climate chaos. According to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute, Biden's budget request is tantamount to climate change denialism. Semler found that despite mentioning some version of tackling the climate crisis nearly a dozen times in his proposal, the president wants to spend 18 times more on the U.S. military-industrial complex, a bigger polluter than 171 countries, than he does on slashing greenhouse gas emissions. Khashoggarian, meanwhile, noted that the U.S. military budget is already more than the next 11 countries combined, 12 times more than Russia's and higher than at the peak of Vietnam War or the Cold War. She added, if more militarism were the key to a stable and secure world, we would already be there.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The United Nations says increasing temperatures and sea levels, changing precipitation patterns, and more extreme weather are threatening human health and safety, food and water security, and socio-economic development in Africa. Tanzania is one of the African countries bearing the brunt of climate change. The country's president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, speaks here at the COP26 conference on how climate change is ravaging her country.
We in Tanzania have not been spared by these events. Sea level rise is eating at arable land. Our pride, the Mount Kilimanjaro, is drastically becoming bald due to glacier melting. And we are experiencing unpredictable floods and droughts.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on how climate change is ravaging Africa. Now, despite not being responsible for causing climate change, it is Africans who are bearing both the brunt and the costs. In the second part of our program, we shall be talking about an upsurge of military takeovers in West Africa. We are asking, what are the underlying factors behind the coups, and are foreign powers involved in the destabilization of this region? Stay with us till the end of our show.
Climate change ravaging Africa. Africa, responsible for just 3% of global emissions, is considered the most vulnerable region to climate change. This has become quite clear from the devastating droughts in Madagascar last year, which the United Nations referred to as climate change famine. Agriculture is the backbone of Africa's economy and accounts for the majority of livelihoods across the continent. The continent is therefore considered an exposure and vulnerability hotspot for climate variability and change impacts.
Elizabeth Wathuchi, an African climate activist, spoke at the COP26 summit and gave a glimpse of climate change impact in Africa.
Our animals and people are dying. I have seen with my own eyes 3 young children crying at the side of a dried up river after walking 12 miles with their mother to find water. Please open your hearts.
Now, to discuss more about climate change and its impact on Africa, we contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist, author, and director of health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot, Mr. Nimo, for your time.
Thank you.
Now, despite contributing almost none of the greenhouse gases that drive the climate crisis, Africa suffers its most brutal consequences. Now, can you explain further on this phenomenon?
Unfortunately, Africa's position in the world geographically is right at the center of the world, and the equator cuts across Africa much more than it does any particular continent. And so Africa has enhanced surface temperature levels than the global average. And this, combined with other climate change factors, exposes the continent to great harm. And so we're seeing increased cyclones on the southeast coast of Africa. We're seeing increased droughts, increased flooding. We're seeing more and more coastal erosion because the continent is surrounded by water. And because the temperature increases more than the global average, about 50% above the global average, this poses very special challenges for the continent.
12 years ago, at a United Nations climate summit in Copenhagen, rich nations made a significant pledge. They promised to channel $100 billion a year to less wealthy nations by 2020 to help them adapt to climate change and mitigate further rises in temperature. That promise was not fulfilled. During the International Climate Summit in Glasgow, COP26, rich countries yet again failed to keep their 12-year-old promise to deliver $100 billion of climate finance to poor nations by 2020.
You know, the refusal of the world to, of the rich nations to put money in the Green Climate Fund is a very clear expression of hypocrisy. Sometimes they pretend that it's about availability of money, that they don't have the resources to invest in building the resilience of poor, vulnerable nations who are suffering consequences of actions they didn't take. But the COVID-19 pandemic showed that rich nations are able to mobilize financial resources at very short notice. The current war between Russia and Ukraine also showed that rich nations are able to invest so much on military warfare, military action, which actually reduces the capacity of nations to withstand global warming. So it's not about non-availability of money. It's a clear case of discrimination, a clear case of avoiding responsibility.
In parts of Africa's Sahel region, climate change is causing more intense and frequent droughts, as well as floods, erratic rainfall, and warming temperatures. As a result, people experience more food insecurity and threats to their livelihood. Terrorist groups are now taking advantage of the situation.
When the wells are empty, I mean, people are have to flee in search of that water, and there are places where people fight for water. It's a source of conflict between communities today.
300,000 people have fled an area where there was once an abundance of water.
Now, there is concern that climate change is a contributing factor to Sahel insecurity and conflict. Now, Mr. Nimo Basse, how serious is this impact?
People sometimes elevate a religious conflict as being the major cause of the instability in the region, whereas actually climate change is the major cause. Take, for example, Northeast Nigeria. Lake Chad is one of the biggest freshwater lakes on the continent, and it has lost 90% of its volume compared to what it had in the 1960s. This has meant displacement of millions of farmers, of fishers, of pastoralists. This naturally generates conflict in the area, and we're going to see this more and more when you look also at what is happening on the Atlantic coastline, where land is being lost at about 2 meters every year.
Last February, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke at a meeting of the African Union Committee of African Heads of State and Government on Climate Change. Ramaphosa said the continent is paying the price for climate change. Let's take a listen.
Climate change impacts are costing African economies between 3 to 5% of their GDPs. Despite not being responsible for causing climate change, it is Africans who are bearing both the brunt and the cost of climate change.
South Africa is one of the regions bearing the brunt of climate change, where cyclones have become a common occurrence, leaving a trail of destruction in countries such as Madagascar, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe.
African countries are being urged by industrialized countries to abandon fossil fuels, yet Western multinationals are busy exploring for oil in Southern Africa. What's your take on this double speak by Western powers?
Again, this is an expression of the hypocrisy we're seeing in geopolitics about power, about self-interest, about xenophobia. And the main thing for us is that some countries have outlawed extraction of fossil fuels in their territories, but their multinational companies are continuing with colonial activities of resource grabbing across the African continent. We are seeing World Heritage locations being desecrated in search for crude oil and gas, as what is happening in both Botswana and Namibia. We must applaud the people of South Africa who have stood up, the artisanal fishers, the coastal communities, the environmental activists, the fishers and the rest, who have stood up against seismic activities being conducted in their water bodies along the coast of the country.
The next climate change conference will be held in Egypt in November this year. African climate activists are calling for tangible action ahead of this meeting.
When it comes to the African continent, it's of course on the front lines of the climate crisis, but it's not on the front pages of the world's newspapers. So I can say that as activists from different parts of Africa, we are doing everything we can to ensure that the challenges that Africa is facing when it comes to the climate crisis are highlighted, and to ensure that stories of different activists from different parts of Africa.
Now, Mr. Basse, what should African countries do to ensure that the COP27 in Egypt meets the continent's needs rather than the interests of Western powers, as was the case in the Glasgow summit?
This will be the fifth conference of parties to be held in Africa, and each time we always think that the interests of Africa will become paramount. Some people are even calling COP27 the African COP, but COP27 would not be an African COP. It would be the same colonial, maladjusted conferences where geopolitics becomes the platform for playing games about power. So what I would think African countries should do is to really sit down together, agree on a roadmap to make fundamental the request on the system, demands on the system. Number one would be to ask for the recognition and payment of climate debt, rather than talking about Green Climate Fund that is not forthcoming. $100 billion a year would not tackle the problem of the climate crisis. Number two would be to not just recognize, but to pay climate debt. And the way to estimate the climate debt would be to estimate the harms done historically and the harms projected to come, such as what we can read from the intergovernmental panel reports that have just been released over the years, have been released over the years. And secondly, which African government should know that it is in our interest to stop investing in dirty energy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ani Mobase, for your insight on how climate change is impacting on Africa. Now, we take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue our program, which is about the recent spate of coups in Western Africa. Stay with us.
Africa's coup belt.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Over the past 2 years, there have been several coups and coup attempts in African nations. In Burkina Faso, Chad, Guinea, Mali, and Sudan, military leaders succeeded in seizing power. In Niger, and most recently in Guinea-Bissau and Djibouti, they failed.
While the COVID-19 pandemic may have negatively impacted on countries affected by military takeover, they were on the precipice of instability long before the emergence of the virus due to deep-seated vulnerabilities such as chronic insecurity, political corruption, and mass unemployment. The leaders of the 15-nation economic community of West African states held an emergency summit in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, early February in response to the coups.
Now, speaking during the conference, Ghana's president and ECOWAS chairman Nana Akufo-Addo said military takeovers must be contained before this trend devastates the whole region.
Let us address this danger, this dangerous trend, collectively and decisively before it devastates the whole region.
Now, for an incisive analysis on the recent spate of military takeovers in West Africa, we have contacted Gilles Yabi, a political analyst and economist. He's also the founder and president of WAPI, the West Africa Citizen Think Tank. Thanks a lot for your time.
A pleasure.
Now, what are the underlying conditions for military takeovers in this African coup belt?
Well, I would say that it's always important not to forget that Africa is a 54 countries continent. So even if we have a series of coup in the last few months on the continent, I think that it cannot be taken as something to be generalized. The reality is that each country still have its own political trajectory, and the coup that we had in the region are really related also to the security situation and very difficult political situation that we know in these specific countries like Mali, Burkina Faso, or Chad. So it is important to look at the particular political trajectory of these countries.
Citizens in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea took to the streets to back the military takeovers. The masses in these countries responded to the news of military takeovers with protests not against the intervening military, but the removed political leaders. Even Malians living in Nigeria have come out to openly back the Malian leadership while rejecting foreign intervention in the country.
We are against anyone where you're coming to do anything for other things for our country. We are against that. We are supporting fully our government and our soldiers presently now. We don't need any intervention to anyone. Again, any foreign soldiers in Mali, we need them to come out from our country. We don't need any of them. They are there to destroy our economy. They are to destroy our society.
We have seen masses in countries such as Burkina Faso and Mali backing military takeovers. So what could be the reason for this?
That's an excellent question. I think that one clear reason or well clear explanation for coup is the anticipation by those who made a military coup that their action will be supported by at least a part of the population and actually a substantial part of the population. And that's what we saw in Burkina Faso and Mali. And that is related to the sense of failed security in the country. So if a civilian government, including an elected government, does not provide a minimum of security to the people, actually, those people think that a military takeover can be a solution.
France defended the Chadian army's takeover of power last year after the battlefield death of President Idriss Déby. Déby's son, Mohamed, took control of the country and its armed forces. He dissolved the parliament and suspended the constitution.
France fully backs these unconstitutional military takeover in Chad. The Israeli regime is also said to back the military regime in Chad and continues to supply lethal weapons to the conflict-ridden country. The African Union insists that it condemns military takeovers without exception. Now, here is the AU Commissioner for Political Affairs, Peace and Security.
The African Union Center for Post-Conflict Reconstruction and Development in Cairo. We are very pleased with the government of the Arab Republic of Egypt for giving us that opportunity to do more research and push for the implementation of programs. But you know, post-conflict is very expensive.
In some countries, such as Chad, the military takeover was endorsed by France and the Israeli regime. Now, what interest do they have in this country and the region as a whole?
The example of Chad is interesting, again, because it shows that each situation has to be analyzed and quite specifically as well. And in the case of Chad, France has been present in the country, have had military presence in Chad for decades. I think it is important to understand that for a country like France, which still pretend to play a global role, it is important for France to have some military presence in Africa, and it is Chad used to be one of the places where French military has been present. I don't think that it is related necessarily to economic interests, but it is clearly related to the need for France to have an influence in Africa that it can use to defend his place in geopolitics globally. Israel, I think, needs some friends, and in the last few years, Israel has been trying to establish diplomatic relationship and economic relationship with a number of African countries.
The countries experiencing the coup epidemic in West Africa are amongst the poorest countries in the world. Some African leaders have guaranteed French companies access to strategic resources such as diamonds, ores, uranium, gas, and oil. This looting of African resources has led to poverty in the region, and this is one of the factors that contributed to the masses backing the military takeovers. A top Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, believes that some powers benefit from the poverty in Africa.
Not be deluded that the world is full of benevolent individuals and institutions whose only claim to fame is that they want to lift Africa from the morass that she now finds herself in. The reality is the poverty of Africa is the glory of some civilizations. Poverty is an industry. Ignorance is an industry. Big industry. And there are those who want Africa to continue to wallow in poverty and to wallow in ignorance because it is their safest bet to their continued benefit.
Africa's coup belt is one of the poorest regions of the world. What is the reason for extreme poverty in this mineral-rich region?
It is clear that the region is very rich in natural resources, but if you don't have the human resources, you don't have a kind of leadership that can negotiate the bitter terms for the extraction and exploitation of your resources, you find yourself in a very difficult situation. And I think that's also why the coup are more symptoms of more structural weaknesses of the countries of the region than the main problem. It could happen only because we have failed governance system. And I think that, again, that we have to look at more nuanced analysis of the economic situation of the countries and the links between the economic situation, the governance system, and also the international system that sometimes doesn't help, actually, with the development of the economies of the region.
Some analysts and leaders in Africa have expressed concern that the trend of military takeover could be replicated in other countries if action is not taken to deal with the underlying factors triggering the coups. President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana has termed the serial coups as contagious and are a matter of grave concern.
Excellencies, the resurgence of coup d'etats in our region is a matter of grave concern. This evolution challenges the democratic way of life we have chosen. We need to stand firm to protect democracy and freedom in our region.
Coups in West Africa seem to be having a ripple effect. And after several successful coups, there have been failed coup attempts in countries such as Guinea-Bissau, Niger, and Djibouti. Now, Dr. Yabi, our last question. Do you think Africa is facing a danger of militarization of politics?
Yes, very certainly a militarization of the continent, and that is a threat, I think, to the continent, the fact that we are having more and more military actors and a lot of different actors on the continent. We also have, with this militarization, more competition of external powers actually trying to have influence in Africa. Again, they are all aware of the demographic trajectory of the continent and the fact that also natural resources are well concentrated in Africa. So it is clear that there are a lot of interest, and this is not already easy. It's not always easy for the countries of the continent to defend their own strategic interests over the long run. But now, there is a sense that this militarization by external powers can also reinforce the political position of military officers in many countries of the continent.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yabi, for your incisive analysis on the recent spate of coups in Africa. We really appreciate it. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today, and it's been great having you watch the program. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.